position.
Right? Okay.
So they're all getting very comfy. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Who is this strange man?
Since these aren't working, do you have any objection to that? This is for radio.
No, I have no objections to anything.
No objections to anything.
My objections have all been completely overridden. Well, go ahead.
Let me pull this up.
Question, Mr. Shatner. Are you committed to another Star Trek film?
No.
My question, I asked last night, and I never did hear what you said. In the second Star Trek, they made quite a thing of the fact that your character had matured some. I mean, he couldn't see without his glasses too well, and you talked about that in press conferences. But in this, I think he's gotten younger. And what was the thinking here? And tell us about that.
Well, the objective thinking is as each year goes by, as we all age, so does Captain Kirk. And I suppose there is the possibility that I'll wheel myself in on a wheelchair, you know, and say, press that button there, you know. That's the idea is not to fight the aging process. Hopefully I can keep it at bay for a brief time to come and still walk up the stairs and fight the bad guy. That's the objective view. The subject of my view of it was of interest to me in that I was shooting this series, T.J. Hooker, last season, and because my contract with Paramount was made prior to my contract with Columbia on Hooker, that contract superseded the Paramount one. And so the movie was delayed. What was supposed to have happened during the hiatus, during the period of time between seasons of T.J. Hooker, but because of the exigencies of the movie business, it was delayed and kept on being pushed back further than T.J. Hooker could take. So with the amount of communication that there was, the good amount of communication there was between both studios, we decided to push up the season of Hooker as the movie got pushed back. And subsequently what happened is we made, I've forgotten how many Hooker segments, 18 or 19, something like that. Before we stopped shooting, everybody was released on Hooker, and I went directly to making that film. I stopped shooting on a Friday, and on a Monday I was before the cameras on the Star Trek. And I continued to shoot the film until the day I finished filming Star Trek. I then began to, you notice how I have to be very careful with these names. And the following day I was in front of the cameras on Hooker. And doing a series is really fatiguing. It's up at 5-6 in the morning and getting to bed. Last night was an exception, I suppose. I was 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and up at 5 this morning. And that goes on for 5 days, and then the weekends are spent trying to recover and get enough strength back so you can start again on Monday. And that's how I went into the film, with that kind of exhaustion. And I could see that on my face, and we started shooting on the bridge, and started with the first scene on the bridge. So that first shot of me that opens the film is me just coming off of T.J. Hooker, and I looked to my eyes, haggard and puffy with fatigue and all the things that happens on a series. But as the ease of making a film began, I could see myself looking better and better. And there was a brief time, a week or so, in which I had off just before the big fight sequence with Krug. And I took that week, and I had gone to the beach over here in Southern California, and I ran and I swam, and I relaxed for the first time in 3 years. And when I came back, we began the fight sequence, and my face, to me, was totally different. And that, subjectively, is what happened to the actor. I got better and better because I got more and more rest.
Been far more on the characters, these
veterans of many years in space. It used to be a little bit, you know, Planet of the Week or God of the Week, and now we're getting to know the characters as human beings far more than in the past. Do you see that as kind of a continuing trend, and are you pleased to have that emphasis on humanity?
Well, it's true that the series always had the problem of the week. I used to call it the monster of the week, you know. And that's the nature of episodic television. And we like to think, if you could hold that for a moment, I'll give you a chance at that, okay? We liked to think on the series that there was a level of humanity and philosophy, if you will, that stood out every so often. And I think that is one of those elements that has made the series popular. When I first heard the conversations about Star Trek I, it was directly after the success of Star Wars. And I think the studio had always held back from doing anything with Star Trek because of their reluctance to believe, and very naturally so, that something like that could have a viable economic life. And then when Star Wars hit and became the major success it was, I used to joke about driving that I thought that when I was driving by, shortly after that Star Wars opened, that shortly after that driving by Paramount, I heard a shot ring out when somebody committed suicide having lost the opening opportunity. So in typical fashion, they said, well, if Star Wars made it, then let's do a Star Trek in the same manner. So Star Trek I was, in my view, an attempt to catch up to Star Wars, which meant making it big and spending $40 million and getting as many special effects as Star Wars had had. And when that, although it made a lot of money, was not a good... I wish I hadn't said that. I didn't mean good. I meant it was not a terrific film. It was a good film, but it was not terrific. It was not in the tradition of Star Trek, because nobody knew by that time everybody had died off who knew what the tradition was in the management area. Everybody had either moved away or died who knew what the elements of Star Trek were. I mean, those of us who did know said, well, if you come in on a close-up of a face, they say, close-up, this is movies. You guys don't know movies. This is, you're used to television. We need grandiose, we need epic proportions. And so that's, of course, it being their money, they won. And this mold of Star Trek was struck. And it made them a great deal of... So then now they had a conflict. It made them a great deal of money, but it was not Star Trek. And they had spent so much money on it. Let me put it this way. They had a large box office, but they had spent so much money they didn't make much profit. So they said, let's spend less money. If we make a next one, let's spend less money and do what you guys want to do and do the humanities. And I think it's an interesting confluence of economics and art that became these last two shows, which is at one point in the series where we didn't have much money for special effects that almost forced us to do human stories. Now we have more money, but they want to save it for special effects, so we're doing human stories. Yes. It's an interesting question. I'd have to think about that, as against not thinking about it and answering it. Well, each director has their own characteristics. Robert Wise came to that film with a legendary, justifiably legendary reputation, and when he said, "This is where we're, you know, we put in the camera here and we're going to go over there," you said, "Yes, sir," because he had won all these Oscars and it meant a great deal. And one didn't question the father figure who knew all and wasn't going to. He was indeed a father figure. Not that he didn't allow us certain freedoms, but he was Robert Wise, the one of the great directors of Hollywood. Nick Meyer had written the script, and we were so in love with the script, and we were so impressed by his creative ability, that although it was only his second picture, we felt that his imagination should be given full flower. And so here he was. He had written the script, but he hadn't directed very much. And whatever help we could give him was proffered, and he would accept or not accept, depending on what he felt was right or wrong. But he had written the script and therefore brought to it another unquestionable aspect. Leonard and I are dearest of old friends, and we had shared a mutual struggle with the management in various things that we struggled with, whether it was a script or a prop or a concept or a dressing room. We were always united. We would go into a dressing room and say, "Well, what are you thinking? And what are you thinking?" We'd have a plan. Whenever we had something to deal, when we were ever going to deal with management, we'd have he and I would have a plan. We were together. We were brothers in flesh and in spirit. And now suddenly my brother was saying, "Now I think you should do this," and I'd say, "Well, wait a minute. I think I should." You know, and it was now, and I felt alone. So there was an awkward period of time for me, and I don't think for Leonard, or maybe so. I've never really talked to him about it. We haven't had a chance. But there was a period of a couple of weeks when I felt alone in anything that I might have objected to, although I had no reason to. Both Harv Bennett and Leonard Nimoy, and to, for that matter, the whole of Paramount's management are nothing but have given nothing but love and affection in those areas. But from my point of view, it was more awkward in the beginning than any of the other two directors. But that slowly erased itself as I realized that Leonard had a point of view and knew what he was doing, and therefore it became fun and good.
On any of these Star Trek pictures, one of the very earliest talking stages, did you ever say, "I'd like to direct"?
No. I didn't say that until recently. It's a difficult question because I'm so tied up here and I'm directing here. But the truth of the matter is I'd like to. It's just a matter of whether I can or not, please.
How much input did you have in the script this time
around? Yeah, well, I had quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, he is more like a technical advisor than a creative force. Harv Bennett is the creative force behind these last two films. Harv Bennett looked at every one of the episodes, absorbed them all. In fact, I don't know whether you've talked to him or not, but he tells the story of not knowing what Star Trek was and then immersing himself in it. And then has become as authoritative as anybody on Star Trekania.
He's done a wonderful job. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, Gene Roddenberry is the father of the creator of the series, of the concept.
Yes, but a father has to say to a child, "Now you have to live on your own, and grow, and go beyond." There's a phrase. I hope I can remember it. No, I can't. Something about a footprint going beyond my own step, going a step beyond my own footprint, something to that effect. Yes?
How come Mayfield Barrett is the only regular cast member who did not continue after the first film?
I don't know. I never thought of that. I don't know the reason for that. Yes?
Yes, how do you feel about so many movies, especially big box office ones, being sequels? Is it just... you know, movies turning into TV series, expensive TV series, just that you have to wait 2 years as opposed to 1 week.
Well, I think that I love the James Bond films. I mean, I go see them when they I can't wait for them to come out. I love them. What else is there? That's about it, isn't it?
Well, you know, Star Wars 3.
Oh, I think they're fantastic. I loved that. I haven't seen... I didn't have a chance to see Star Trek 3, and I haven't seen this latest Raiders picture. But I think that, for in my opinion, if the sequel can take the elements of what made the first picture successful and progress them to and fulfill them, then I think it's terrific. If it's an imitation, Roman art to Grecian art, then it lacks and it's a ripoff. I hope that's not so in our case. Excuse me, I know you two have asked, and I'm going to get to you. Let me see if there's anybody else who wants to ask a question, and then I'd be delighted to come right back to you. Hold on, just pause 1 second. Yes.
Yes, the woman up front there mentioned earlier about the weak eyesight and the granny glasses, and I noticed that we didn't see much of the granny glasses.
Well, it was there, but they cut the scene out, interestingly enough. When looking at, when getting the clue for who was carrying Spock's marbles, I used the granny glasses then. For some reason, we didn't see them the way it was edited. I beg your pardon? I'm sorry. Would you say that again, please?
It's in one of the still pictures. Oh. That didn't show up in the movie.
It was a matter of the editing, and I don't know why it wasn't there. Yes.
What part of this film did you find the most moving and why?
Oh. What part did I find the most moving? I saw it for the first time last night. Oh, yeah, I've never seen the film before. Since, what's it been, six months since we finished filming, I saw maybe 10 minutes of spotted film as I dubbed, looped some of it, but that's the first time I'd seen it. So all I can tell you is my impression is the death of David, I guess, is the moment. Yes, dear.
Star Trek fans are kind of like Rosicrucians in the pyramids. They seem to read all sorts of things into Star Trek, deep philosophical something. And when you talk to them, they have trouble explaining what they read.
What they read.
What do you think is the deep philosophical message of Star Trek?
Of which Star Trek?
Any of them. Just Star Trek per se.
That's like saying, what's the deep philosophical message of the Bible? I mean, I don't know. Pick a segment, and we'll read something into it. Yeah, I know. Well, you see, by the same token, your question evokes certain levels of meaning there. I mean, there's a certain hostility in the question, then there's a certain desire for information, and then, you know, I mean, one could say hello and say, what did he mean by that, you know? So you can read, if you wish to read something into it, you can do so. Although I must tell you that there were many segments in which there was a desire to lay something in. Peace, love, equality, I mean, all the verities of democracy and Christianity are in there. At the same time, there was a Star Trek edict put out, and the only thing I can remember about that was something about letting aliens be themselves, because the diversity of life is. So maybe if you wanted to sum up what Star Trek means, as against Turn the Other Cheek being the summation of Christianity, the diversity of life and its beauty could be summed up in... God, I got through that one.
I've seen you on the CBC, Stratford, and I just wondered if your experiences at McGill, Stratford, and the CBC, if your Canadian experiences were really what prepared you for moving into the more important American market as an actor.
Are you Canadian or American?
Canadian.
Then you have just exposed your Canadian inferiority by saying superior American markets.
I'm glad you, that's the answer I was looking for.
Yes. No, the Canadian market is as important as the American market, except it's more important to Canadians than it is to Americans. But I'm a Canadian. I don't think there's any such thing as a more important market as an actor or as an artist. The market you wish to reach is the individual. I can't be responsible in answering your question to everybody, but I hope I'm communicating myself to you so that you play for the audience of one, especially in films, which is usually taken as the director, but I tend to read it as the camera. I play to convince the camera that what I'm doing is really happening. And in the theater, the audience itself becomes one mass, and you hope that that audience... The audience I felt last night was with... It was a bizarre experience, actually, if you wish to hear a little bit of it. I'm an actor from the theater, and I have had many occasions in which I have moved people from the stage and heard the people, felt the people and heard them, being moved to laughter or tears. That's the common experience to the stage actor, and that's what makes stage actors stage actors. That's why they want to do the stage. There I was, a film actor at this point, watching myself on film and being part of and yet removed from an audience that was being moved by me. Can you understand those levels? And it's not Star Trekian. So I had a really multi-leveled experience last night, and there was no more important or less audience. That audience last night in that theater could have been in and was, by the way, in Bangladesh. Apparently in Bangladesh we're very popular, so I mean it's as important to be popular in Bangladesh as it is in Canada. Okay, does that get you? Yes.
So what do you like to do? What project are you interested in?
What project?
Yeah, besides Egypt.
I'm glad you asked that. I have, over the years, become tremendously interested in horses and dogs. I breed both horses and dogs. And at the moment, I could use the word safely, obsessed with my horses. I find myself preparing, I find that I'm preparing myself to compete both in a, and this may not be too familiar to you, quarter horses, cutting quarter horses. Do you know what I'm talking about? No? No, I know you do, but I'm wondering if this gentleman does. Where are you from, sir? Japan. Well, in America, the cowboy rode a horse and worked cattle. And the horse they rode was usually a quarter horse. The way they cut the cattle up away from, separated the cattle, was work to them, and they used a horse that was trained to do that, a cutting horse it was called. I breed those horses for cutting, but now this cutting has become a game and a contest for which there are large purses. I breed the horses that these cowboys buy. There's also another breed of horses that there's another type of horses that I breed, which is the American saddlebred horse. This is a show horse. It's like the ballet dancer. I own the 2-year-old world champion saddlebred, the entire title is Fine Harness Saddlebred Horse, and he is competing for his 3-year-old world championship in August. So I have become totally involved in my horses and the breeding and the competition where I will show these horses and in the other quarter horses compete in the cutting, so you can see how busy my life is. And in my lunch hours here, where I would be today if it weren't for the joy of meeting you all, is I'd be 5 minutes from here with several of my horses riding during my lunch hour, and then I come back and continue the day on Hooker.
What's the name of the horse?
The name of the horse, gosh, is Sultan's Great Day.
Sultan's Great Day,
an American saddlebred horse who will be at the Kentucky State Fair, which is the largest state fair in America, at the horse show there, which is the largest horse show in America, and that's in August 16th, 17th, somewhere around there, middle of August. I will be there in that competition for the world championship there. Yes. No, Patrick.
What kind of sound do you...
I'm finding that what my mother said is true. You can't talk and eat with your mouth full.
Secondly, I was a little curious about the ending of the last film. And so
the last film?
Star Trek II.
Okay.
And the beginning and the resolution of this film about bringing back a character to life who's dead. That's kind of a faux pas in films, even though I guess Bill would do it with E.T. and it happens from time to time. Was there I've read, and we all have, I guess, your quote, saying we couldn't have turned to the camera at the end and said we couldn't find him or whatever that was. But was there ever any trepidation about we just can't do this, we can't bring back a character?
It was never anticipated. An accident happened. Maybe it wasn't an accident if you don't believe in accidents. It was really very very strange. I better keep this tie on when I take some pictures. We were getting ready to do the death scene of Spock in that engineering room, and this wasn't scripted, and Leonard pinched DeForest and DeForest fell, and then he put his hand on his thing and he said, and he was looking for something misterioso, Leonard was, and he put his hand on things to remember, and off he took, and then with the death scene Spock dies because Leonard didn't want to play Spock anymore. Okay, so we said, okay, Leonard doesn't want to. They argued and went through every possible permutation and combination to get Leonard to play Spock, and Leonard said, look, I've spent my adult life playing Spock. I want to go on to other things. It is stifling my career, stifling my creative impulses. I need to stop. Very understandable. And we were all very pained, but understood it completely. This was the death of Spock. But for some reason, Leonard said, remember. It was mysterious. It was Vulcan. It was meaningful to somebody in Star Trek, but we didn't know what. And that was the end. Spock was dead, and the question was, would there be a Star Trek III, and how could you do it without Spock? And that was a whole other question. But as far as everybody was concerned, connected with the Star Trek, Spock was dead. Then the possibility of Leonard directing the film came up. And Leonard said, if I can direct the film, I'll play Spock. And then the problem was, how do we bring him back to life? And Harve Bennett, in a tremendous creative leap, used that remember and brought him back in a very viable, valid science fiction way, I think. And so it was an accident or fortuitous circumstances or fateful, I don't know. Let me get some people who haven't asked questions, and then I'll get back to you. You haven't asked a question.
I'm thinking about your work with the horses. I was thinking about Paul Newman's work in racing, where sometimes those other interests are limited because of the pressures brought upon you by fans and media attention. You cannot pursue hobbies with much freedom.
Right.
Have you found that to be the case?
Sure. I mean, one tends to fall off of horses, for example. And one tends to look like a fool when you're lying on the ground. The horses, that's not the way to ride a horse. My basic understanding is you're to stay on the horse. And there's even a picture published of me lying on the ground with the horse running off. I invited some photographer to this ranch I have where I breed these horses, and we'll get on a horse. I said, well, this nice horse here, one of the horses we ride, I'll get on him, and the saddle is way up. Well, I don't need a saddle. I got on the horse bareback, and the flashbulb made the horse jump, and I came off, and the guy took the picture of me landing on my back, the horse slightly rearing. I said, don't, come on, hey, you know, don't publish. He said, that picture's dead. Well, of course, it appeared in the magazine. But I don't care. My love for the animals are such that I fully expect to, and in fact perhaps intend to make a fool of myself while I learn, and I don't care. Hang on a second. And I think you've asked, have I asked you, you know what, yet? No.
I haven't been submitted one question.
Then let's...
But much has been written and said about Leonard Nimoy's unhappiness playing Spock, and you said the stipend of the career and that sort of thing. How do you feel about...
You're a Canadian too.
Yes.
Yes.
Keep me on the curve. Do you feel stifled? Do you feel
rather than receive money, to tackle the roles that I have been asked to do in these last two films. I just love being Captain Kirk in the way they've been writing for him.
How do you find people reacting to you in terms of television, your T.J. Hooker?
Well, I think it's summed up by some kid telling his mother, this was told to me the other day, there's T.J. Hooker on Star Trek. And then the other one was, which actually happened. Somebody came up to me and said, "Would you sign, please, T.J. Kirk?" You know. the one behind you, honey.
How many people knew the secret of Spock coming back, and how did they keep the secret?
The scripts were numbered. This is bizarre. Well, no, it isn't, because it was a desire. It was bizarre. The scripts were numbered, and everybody was responsible for their numbered script. But not only that, and I don't know whether this was for real or whether it was a scare tactic. They said it was printed in such a manner that they could tell. I've forgotten how it worked, but in any case, if it was Xeroxed, if any page was zero, every page had a number stamped on it, but even so, there was a way of telling where it came from if it were Xeroxed. And it was very cloak and dagger for the longest time, and I mean real cloak and dagger. They had real people really guarding that script. People were not given the last pages. We were asked to be promised not to say anything about the ending, all in a desire to protect the story so that the people coming to see it wouldn't know what they were going to see, which it seems to me an honest desire to entertain. And then the trade magazines give away the whole plot in their reviews. I mean, I couldn't believe that. Hang on a second. Who have we had? You wait just a minute. Wait a minute. We'll get to repeats in a second. You have them, please. Okay.
I once worked at a Star Trek convention in which you were besieged by fans, and this was during the middle period where you were still prior to the movie, the series had been off for some time, and I wondered how you felt during that period of time to be so identified with a character. Well, obviously, I would imagine you were trying to make other leaps, other steps as an actor. Was there ever a time when it felt just oppressive and you wished that you could be rid of it?
Well, I think that must have been so in the earlier years, but you know what happened with those conventions, of which I attended very few. There'd be as many as 15,000 people just sitting where you're sitting, but in an amphitheater that way. And I started off small, and I've forgotten where the first one was, where I was had a microphone. I thought, God, I hope they like me. I mean, what if I make an inadvertent Freudian slip, like saying good and meant terrific? You know, I mean, things you can't recapture, and suddenly everybody knows. You know, you've revealed yourself unconsciously, and that's even worse, you know, because now that's the real truth. You're naked. But I progressed from a couple of small conventions where I would have 1,000 people. I mean, an audience of 1,000. You play in the theater, 500, 1,000 is a nice sized theater. To answering a question as forthrightly as you can, with the firm belief that I'm a nice guy and I'm trying honestly to answer your question, and if I tell you the wrong thing, or if I can't help that, and basically what I'm trying to do is give you entertainment and some fun and try and cull from my experiences and the distillation of what I have experienced something interesting, okay? I went from that to 15,000 people and standing there on my feet not knowing what the next word was going to be, just like this. I mean, it's awesome. And making them laugh and making them cry and telling stories and remembering things that had happened, because what I'm doing is distilling my experience of one kind or another. In effect, I'm being an artist. I'm distilling life that, as I see it, into a story, into an answer that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. From that, I went on to, having used that experience of being in 15,000 people and being like a rock show and getting applause and people standing at the end and applying, like looking at them, my gosh, was it that, you know, going from that to a one-man show, modestly in front of 18,000 people, opening a one-man show in front of 18,000 people at the Hollywood Bowl, and culminating on a summer's evening at Anaheim Stadium in front of 35,000 people, alone on stage with a 75-piece orchestra behind me, a 60-foot screen doing back projection and doing the ending of the world that I had memorized, and not hearing a whisper from 35,000 people when I was done, and hearing tears. That all came from the experience of being able to take a group of people and to just speak to them. And what I did was find somebody else's words to speak to them. I think that had a major effect on myself as an actor in being able to reach out and do a one-on-one to 35,000 people.
It's a beautiful look, you know, the look of love. I was just wondering how you feel as an actor playing the part, and you know how you feel about the destruction of the Enterprise in
oh.
this last movie. Does it affect you personally? And
the magic of film. I looked up into the soundstage and had to imagine the star. The you know, of course, you know, I that was laid in months later. I don't know the answer to this. But with the fertile brains at work, something will happen whereby the Enterprise, not the one that is destroyed, because that's gone. I don't think we can fool the audience again in that way, that it's resurrected. But in some fashion, we're not going to have to. We're not going to walk from star to star. I think is. Yes.
Last night, the picture, though the Spock character kind of hovered in the background and his presence was felt, Leonard Nimoy actually was hardly in the film at all, and the film was very well received.
Yes.
Do you think you could make several more Star Trek pictures without Leonard Nimoy at all, without Spock at all?
I wouldn't even want to consider it. I think that when asked, what are the ingredients of Star Trek, what makes Star Trek so popular, you and I would point at the same things and still not have the answer. I mean, when we go to itemize them, the science fiction, the action, the philosophical undertones, the family of players, the cloak and dagger, whatever you point at, all those elements we know, but we still don't know why Star Trek is successful. There is the chemistry of a hit show there, and we don't know what it is. We just know that there are certain obvious elements, and that's why writers will write a book, a movie, a play, and in the next of their in the next edition of their talents, it's a bomb, and it's the same guy, and he should very well have been able to recreate that, and they don't because they you don't know what you the writer only goes from what amuses him, what entertains him, and sometimes he wins and sometimes he loses. So we don't really know the exact formula of Star Trek, and therefore the danger of altering any of the elements is to alter the possibility that it could be successful. Now, obviously, Leonard Nimoy as Mr. Spock is a major element, so I think it's essential that he be in it. Yes?
Will Nimoy's
Well, I don't know the answer to that either, but I would surmise that when Leonard was able to leverage his desire to direct, and again, if I need to say this, I hope I don't need to, but I will, the very natural desire to grow and expand his horizons as an artist, he wanted to direct the film, and he was able to do so, and he did it extraordinarily well. So he was able to use the leverage of, if you want me to be Spock, I want to direct. Great. I would think that those men who said finally, all right, made some kind of a deal that if you want to direct, you're going to come back. You know, I mean, I know I would. So I would think that that's in place someplace, at least for number four.
Possibility.
Where would you like to see them go? I mean, what would you like to see happen as far as your character and the other characters?
Well,
it's kind of an open end.
Right, it is totally open end, because unless Harv has got some storylines in his mind that he hasn't talked about, it's a blank page at the moment. I mean, literally a blank page. I have two things that I'd like to see. One, and they're contrasted and yet they're unified. One is I'd like to see romance, and I would like to see gritty realism. A lot of handheld cameras and dirt under the fingernails and real steel clanging doors and right, yeah.
Is there a particular director you would like to work with on a future Star Trek film?
Well, there are a number of bright young directors who are making their mark, and it seems to me that the best thing that we could do at Star Trek is to bring some brilliant young director, and I come back to that word young, in that where he wouldn't be afraid to try new things and not let stodgy tradition get in his way. I don't think I should mention any names. It's just that there are a group of fine directors who are doing the best work, and I'd love to see them come and do a Star Trek movie, who may never have had anything to do with science fiction, or indeed somebody who is known for science fiction, but not Star Trek.
You'd like to see Captain Kirk or Admiral Kirk get a younger crew eventually. That's something that's going to happen sooner or later. And how would you go about
So first of all, you got to shoot them. I can't answer that. Everybody there is beloved, and I don't know how you handle that.
I interviewed Harv Bennett a few days ago, and he said that he, at the end of Star Trek III, left a platform for that to happen, which I really didn't see at the end of this picture. For the introduction of younger crew members, because
Do you know I'm as much in the dark as you are? I should be more light. I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea. One could speculate, but then what good is that? Yes.
You just finished making a movie in Vancouver.
Yes.
Could you talk about that?
I think it's going to be. I think it's going to be good. I usually shy away from something that I've done that may not have a stamp of some quality to it. I mean, I shy away from talking about it because I don't like too much of what I do. And so when I like something, I'll talk about it. And this is called Trick Eyes. And the director was Billy Graham. And the two ladies with me are Sybil Shepherd and Michelle Phillips. And it's about a married man who, seeking more excitement, gets hung up on prostitutes and the subsequent problems. It sounds a little strange, but it is really the story of a marriage and its strain and what happens thereafter. It was extremely well written by a man by the name of Dennis Nemec, and he had worked a year on the script, which is very rare, and it was a lovely piece of material, and I think we did it well. And it may be among the good things that I've ever done. And I'd sure like you to watch it when it comes on and give me your opinion.
What's yes? It like working in Vancouver?
It's one of the great cities of the world. It's one of my favorite cities. It's like a small San Francisco. It's like San Francisco must have been 30, 40 years ago. It was it's a terrific city. Yes?
How do you choose your project? Like a producer or story or director or manual? And why did you
Oh, visiting hours. Sneaky Oriental devil. I shouldn't have done it. I made a mistake. I think at that time there was a lot of money involved. Yeah, I regret doing it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but how do you
choose? Oh, how do I choose it? Well, I guess in that case I chose money. The material.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I see. I didn't want to work. I didn't want to do it. I wanted to rest for 3 months. And instead I went off and spent the whole time, almost 6 weeks of it, doing a movie because the story was so good. So it just changes. Sometimes, if you're lucky, all the things you mentioned work in one. And then sometimes there's one overriding element, which could be, in this case, was the story. Sometimes it's the people.
Yes. I heard something that's probably not accurate, but might be. I heard that you were reluctant to do Hookah, and Jay talked you into it or encouraged you to do it. Were you in any way reluctant to do another TV series or do Hookah for any reason or whatever?
Well, T.J. Hooker has had a strange evolution. T.J. Hooker was a series called... The Protectors. Thank you. I was looking in vain to Dick Gutman, whose memory is shorter than mine. It was called The Protectors, in which a character by the name of T.J. Hooker was like the father figure in Dallas. You know, and there were all these young policemen with their girls and things running around. And it was an interesting character, and it seemed like a good job, a way of... breaking away from other roles that I had been offered, and it seemed like a good thing to do, and so I did it. But the character kind of overshadowed the rest, and Spelling Goldberg asked me if I would do it as T.J. Hooker. So it didn't start off to be. I didn't start off to be the male lead in a series. It started off to be a whatchamacallit, you know what I mean, everybody together, an ensemble show, which was all right because it didn't mean these long hours. And so it's turned out to be different than I expected, and which is both good and bad, but I think the good outweighs the bad. Hang on a second. Anybody questions in here? Yeah, yes, sir.
Would you like to do more work in Canada? Is it the availability of work to teach you down here?
Well, it's twofold. I haven't really, in all honesty, been offered anything particularly good from Canada. There have been a lot of good work done up there, but none offered to me when I was available. I haven't been available in 3 or 4 years. But there was a spate of time there when Canada's film industry was flourishing, and I would have loved to have been a part of it, but it didn't work out. I brought some projects up, which I couldn't sell, and now I presume they would want me to come up, and I'm not available. But I would like very much to add to the Canadian film industry, very much so.
You're still a citizen?
Yes. No, not really. I don't have a feverish desire to do something. I did a lot of comedy on Broadway, and some people think I'm amusing, and I would like to do more comedy, perhaps. But and then some people think I'm just in comedy whenever I am performing, like in Visiting Hours. I thought that was quite a comedy. Yes, go ahead.
When T.J. Hooker became a series and became successful, I looked at that and interpreted that as a blessing for your career. And especially looking at the old days of Hollywood, when a great actor, for instance, like Basil Rathbone, would find himself suddenly typecast in a role and be unable to break the mold. Do you think that today just the industry in general is more open-minded about what an actor is capable of doing?
No, I think typecasting is part and parcel of what this industry is. It's the need for a project to be successful. So much money, even in the old days. I mean, I don't have any figures on this, but I would imagine the comparative dollar values aren't that different. I mean, Gone with the Wind and in its dollars were equivalent to whatever is spent today and on down. I mean, if something is not successful, there's a great deal of suffering, mostly from the leading actors, the producer, studio, the heads of the studio. I mean, a thing like Cimino's film wreaks havoc in every area. Heads are lopped, and years go by before those people can work again. So the desperation to have a success, or even moderately, even make your money back, would be satisfactory. Therefore, they need known elements. And a known element is an actor who was successful in a racing movie. Let's put him in this other racing movie, or, you know. So it's the requisite of the money people to have the known elements. What is strange but true, and it's a truth that very few of those people recognize, is the successes come from the things that aren't typical, and suddenly they set whole new trends. So that's the conflict in a man who wants to make movies mine.
You mentioned before that T.J. Hooker started out as an ensemble piece, and in a way, although you're the hero, Star Trek is an ensemble piece. There are a lot of characters that people have a lot of feeling for.
Oh, I don't mean that you don't act with somebody if you're playing the lead.
No, I know, but I guess over the years, the other characters have become very important as well to a lot of people. Is it difficult when you're doing these films to make sure that everyone has their say? So
yes. Yes, I mean, you're dealing with a group of children who say, I want love, you know, and not me, but the people are saying, yes, I love you, and I love you, and I love you, and I love you, you know. We'll all go in there. If you get a candy, you're going to get a candy, you're going to get a candy, you know. Yes, there is that family thing that doesn't exist in any other film that I know of. I mean, an actor is hired, and he doesn't come in and say, I'd like more to do. He says, yes, I'll do this job, or I won't do this job. You know?
Is effort made to try and...
Oh, sure. And I think you can see that.
Has Paramount been fair to the characters as far as money?
No, they haven't. When Star Trek was made as a series, as against now, after 5 reruns, there was no more money paid to the actors. So shortly after Star Trek went into syndication, it went through 5 reruns. From that moment on, nobody got paid in even a residual. I mean, there were no residuals. We're talking about $100 or at that time or whatever it was. There is no money given out to the actors in the form of residuals. So what happened is a lot of those people had their face in front of the public year after year in a role that they became identified with and were never compensated for. And a lot of companies, Paramount, NBC, Norway, made, not Norway, Paramount and NBC have made a lot of money on Star Trek. And many of the actors, excuse me, have not. And it is patently unfair. I have to make this the last question. I have to get back on the set. Yes?
You were quoted, this goes back several years, but I recall you being quoted somewhere saying that...
In answer, I have an addendum to that question, which is, it's unfair, but it is contractually so. Nobody is screwing anybody. It's just the way it is. Those are the facts. There was no residuals paid, because that was the law, and so 10 years later... Why should that happen? You understand?
Yeah. But, as I go back several years, I quoted as saying that
Uh-huh.
Did that eventually change? Did you all eventually get something from
no.
the reruns?
Mm-mm, not all, no. No, that picture that I've just described has not changed for most of the actors, no.
Did it ever change for you? Did you ever get residuals?
My position is a little bit different than that, yeah. Thank you very much for coming. Please, yes.
Thank you very much for sharing your time. I appreciate very much if you sign this for me.
Sure.
My name is Gene G.N.
Can I talk in? I could talk in one last night.
I'll take that from last night.
So, thank you.
I'd be glad.
I would love it.
I live in G.E.N.
Yeah, sure.
I live in Winnipeg. Ever been there?
Winnipeg? No, I haven't. But they got some good theater.
It's Marky Hall's hometown.
I know.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I think you did a fantastic job today.
I appreciate
Thank
you doing it for me because.
Thank you. Give me the.
Yeah, Peter thing. Peter would have broken his heart.
You didn't get to eat your sandwich.
Well, I will now. How shall I make that up?
Ellen.
Ellen, this pen isn't writing. There we go.
Uh-huh. It doesn't write on these. Thank you very much.
You
shouldn't get this close.
The title of the movie in Vancouver, Sneaky Eyes.
Trick Eyes, as in prostitute trick.
Gotcha. Thank you so much.
What kind of dogs do you breed?
Dobermans.
Dobermans.
How should I make that out?
So Dan, D-A-N?
Yes.
And Dave? Did you say I'm Dave?
Just the...